Continuing with the biography of Sayyidina Umar radiallahu anhu, some Christian and Orientalist historians have tried to paint the Islamic futuhat, all the conquests during the time of Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu, Umar radiallahu anhu, Uthman radiallahu anhu, Ali radiallahu anhu. They called it religious wars. Right? Religious wars. They claimed that Muslims were men of religion, but they behaved with blind bigotry and made people enter their faith by force and compulsion. This is a big lie. Very, very far from the truth. They claim that they traversed oceans of blood and cold-heartedness, holding the Quran in one hand and sword in the other hand. So, different authors, these Orientalist authors, etc. So, one of them, Napier, right? He says, it was essential for Islam to continue its aggressive policy and to enforce through the blade of sword its desire to enter all people in Islam, or at least to spread its global hegemony. However, it is inevitable for any religion to influence its followers to wage war at some point in its life, and Islam was no different. But the claim that Muslims purposefully spread their religion by force, or that they were more hostile than others, should be absolutely refuted. Some Orientalists refuted this accusation and described the Islamic conquest in excellent terms. Right? So there's another person by the name of Von Kramer. So he says, the Arab Muslims were the personification of a noble character during their wars. Their Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam declared it impermissible to kill those who were disinclined to the world, women, children, and also those who had some deformity, they were blind or crippled or whatever. It's not permissible to kill those people. He also made it unlawful for them to destroy farms, to cut down trees, right? Unless there was some maslihat, then that was allowed. But generally, Muslim armies won't do that. They won't cause destruction. Muslims followed this instruction in extreme detail in their wars. They did not desecrate holy places and things, nor did they destroy plantations. When the Romans used to pelt them with poisoned arrows, the Romans used to put poison on their arrowheads. Right? That was the chemical warfare of that time. Right? When the Romans did this, they did not reciprocate crime with crime. They didn't say, now, okay, let's we also put poison now and do the same. No, they didn't do that. Roman armies had developed a habit of looting villages and setting them on fire. Whether they were advancing or retreating, they would do this, burn the whole place up. Like what these zalims are doing in this era also. On the contrary, the Muslims were safeguarded against trying such tactics by their exemplary moral constitution. Their morals didn't allow them to do this. And you see that even now. That the prisoners that the Mujahideen are holding, what they could have done to them by now? But they looked after them, fed them, clothed them, saw to their medical needs. Although on that side, their prisoners that are held by a regime that's got so much of wealth, they don't even feed them. They persecute them, torture them. Torture that's unheard of, inhumane, barbaric behavior. So these people could have said, yeah, let's take revenge now on the captives that we got. But they don't do that. This is why so many of these captives, they only got good things to say. You only got good things to say. When they are being released, the Jewish captives, the Muslims are releasing them, it's like a disgrace for their people. How they are so happy with their captors, the people who kept them. Somebody sent me one article that one of the prisoners who were held by the Mujahideen, so while he was in captivity by them, his wife had given birth at home. His wife gave birth. So he was telling this captor that, you know, my wife is due any time, and now, you know, she must be gave birth also, and I'm here like this side. So when they were releasing him, his captor gave him a set of earrings. He said, when you're going home, take this for your daughter. This is the morals of Muslims. Morals of Muslims. Another person by the name of Rosenthal, he says, Islamic civilization grew due to openness to debate different ideological movements present, not an introversive call towards blind faith. Above all, it progressed due to its modernity, which pulled down the ancient barriers of customs and linguistics. Hence, a rare opportunity firmed up for all the peoples and civilizations to start a new intellectual life on the basis of total equality with the spirit of open competition. And today, we Muslims, we think we backwards. What he's saying is Islam brought modernization. Islam got rid of all the old ways of treating people differently. Islam brought a system of equality. Everybody must be treated the same. And we think that, no, this is how they made us think. Historical facts lay credence to the fact that Muslims never forced anyone to accept Islam. They didn't force anybody. Following the saying of Allah Ta'ala, La ikraha fid deen. Allah, there is no compulsion in religion. You don't force somebody to accept the deen. So why did people turn to Islam in their multitudes in conquered lands? This was due to what they felt from Islam itself. And they saw the beauty of Islam. It's a great blessing. And the Muslims who were representing Islam, they represented Islam in such a beautiful way that the people that they conquered wanted to accept the religion. You know, Aziz Mu'in Patel Sahib Rahmatullah Ali, he used to always, when he used to make dua, he used to say that, Ya Allah, we are standing at the door of Islam. We ourselves, we don't go in properly, and we don't allow anybody else to come in too. But the way we, our akhlaq, the way we deal, the way we, you know, carrying ourselves, other people who are not entering, and we too, we're not entering properly, we too standing there at the door. We're not entering properly, he said. They found the Muslims to be the embodiment of Islamic akhlaq, adhering to its instructions. They found Muslim commanders and mujahideen who used to call them towards Islam to be practicing what they preached. They were practicing also, not just preaching and doing their own thing. Do what I tell you to do, don't do what I do. Don't do what I do what I tell you to do. It wasn't a case of that. Their akhlaq and behavior was the very best that history can muster. They were ordered by their khulafa and superiors to adhere to seeking help from Allah Ta'ala, fearing Allah Ta'ala, preferring the akhirat over the world, sincerity in jihad, seeking Allah Ta'ala's pleasure in every deed and keeping away from sins. They had a burning desire to free other nations and individuals from worshipping other slaves of Allah Ta'ala to worshipping Allah alone. Remove them from hardships of this world to the expanse and luxury of the akhirat. Moreover, the Muslim commanders used to be at the forefront of the battles. Muslim commanders never sit at home and send the people in the battlefield. No. They were in the forefront of the battlefield. Their families also were in the forefront. So they were the ones who used to receive the first blows. Hence a great many of them were made shaheed. Despite this, the same commanders could be seen right behind their troops in peacetime, taking care of them and being on the front line while preaching Islam. They used to apply the concepts of Islamic warfare fully. The truth is that Muslims used to wage jihad in the way of Allah Ta'ala, not war. They waged jihad fi sabilillah. They didn't wage war. In the sense that how other people are perpetrating war crimes and all this, Muslims never did this. They came to cut somewhere else, come back here later. Yes, Safwan is there. Just tell him. Who's cutting? Umar radiallahu anhu's methodology in selecting commanders, how he selected commanders. We did this in the beginning of when I see it comes again here. So he used to say many a times that he who appoints an evildoer as a commander, you're appointing an evildoer knowingly, then he too is an evildoer. When he sent a message to Sa'id bin Amir to appoint him the governor of a part of the Levant, and he declined, Umar radiallahu anhu said, "By the one in whose hand is my soul, I will not let you people place this responsibility on my neck and you want to sit yourselves at home." In other words, you have made me the Amir al-Mu'mineen. Right? So now, the cream I'm appointing as the governors, the pious people, honest people. Now, when I'm appointing you, you're declining your appointment. So I won't allow this. You will have to take that position as governor, like how I have to be the Amir al-Mu'mineen, you must take this position. A lot of times you find this, right? You find this happening, that people, you know, one day, or let's just run through these points first and then I'll explain this thing to you. So a commander should be known for patience. And he must be a person who has got forethought. He can see ahead. He, you know, Allah Ta'ala gives him that sight. Then the commander, he must be brave and he must be a good archer. Because obviously that was the weapon that was used at that time, right? In today's time now, you must know how to use whatever modern day weapons are being used. When he wished to appoint the overall commander for the conquest of Nahavand, so he consulted the people. They said, "Oh Amir al-Mu'mineen, you know best the people of Iraq and the army there. In other words, you decide." So Umar radiallahu anhu said, "By Allah, I will appoint the one who has the oldest arrowhead from amongst them." So he said, if I meet him tomorrow, I'll appoint him. So they asked, "Who are you referring to?" So he said, "Nu'man bin Muqarrin Muzani." The people exclaimed that he is indeed worthy of it. Right? So one is, he must be pious. The second thing, he must be have patience, forethought. Then he must be brave. And then he must also be proficient in using the weapons of war. Then he must be intelligent and experienced. mazhab tajruba. Sometimes you get a person who is very, very pious and everything, but he doesn't have that intelligence. So that person also, you can't put him as a leader, as a commander. He should be skilled, having the ability to make decisions on the battlefield. He mustn't be a person who gets overwhelmed and he can't think. He must be able to take decisions and think on his feet, take decisions under tense situations. He's mentioned here, the qualities of a commander. He should be wise, intelligent, brave, insightful in terms of battle, well-versed in war strategy and deceptive tactics. He should be trustworthy, kind and sincere to the Muslims. That is why Umar radiallahu anhu chose Sa'ad radiallahu anhu to lead the Iraqi campaign after making mashura with the people. Then he must have interest in what he is doing. His heart must be there. If a person's heart is not there, then again, he can have all these qualities, but if his heart is not in it, so those are some sifat. Umar radiallahu anhu used to look for this sifat when he is appointing somebody as a commander. I don't even know what I was supposed to tell you now. Bulmaya. What we are talking about? I was explaining to you that sometimes if Allah Ta'ala has blessed us with something, and now when the occasion comes to use that thing for His deen, then we shy away, thinking that we are acting humble. That's not humility. Then you're being stingy or you're showing off. One of the two. Once we were traveling in India, Mufti Hashim Bodha Sahib was in that Jamaat, right? In that group. I was the youngest person there. So it was Ramadan Sharif, and we stopped. Because we are too far to make it to any village. So we stopped in the Khet there, and we had some things to break our roza. Now we're waiting for the time of sunset. So in India, what happens is, when it's the sunset time, they shoot a cannon. Different villages shoot a cannon. Because people never had watches and all that, or timetables and everything. So they shoot a cannon. When they sight the moon also, they shoot a cannon. When you see the Ramadan moon, they shoot a cannon. Then Sehri time in Jalalabad, one person, he used to ride a bicycle. He go through all the streets. Right? Sehri, 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 midnight, wake everybody up for Sehri, right? And then, when it's almost time is up, again he'll go with his bicycle now. He had one thing he hits. Everybody knows now, time is almost up now. Stop eating. So then they used to shoot this cannon. Jalalabad also they used to shoot a cannon. So we're waiting now to hear that the cannon, then we know it's iftar time, so we can break our roza. So after that is Maghrib time now. So Mufti Sahib, he didn't wait for people to decide now who's going to perform the namaz and all that. When it was Maghrib time, he took the imam's position. Because he was the only alim there, right? Other people were businessmen and involved in other things, right? So he was the only alim. So he was the rightful person to make the imamat. Right? Now a lot of times a takaza comes, hey, we need somebody for Jummah somewhere. Don't go there. Right? What we studied for? What we studied for? If we can't put ourselves forward for the takaza, what we studied for? Takaza is there. You not going everywhere and saying, hey, put me there, put me here, put me. No, you're not asking for it. But now there is a takaza, is there, they need somebody there. Now that's not the time to put your head down now. That's the time to now avail yourself. There is a takaza of deen, now I must put myself forward and I must go and do it. You know, I'm not this thing. So, you're worthy to eat the food. You're worthy to sleep on the bed. We're not worthy of anything. Everything Allah Pak gave us, we're not worthy of it. Who can say they're worthy to give a bayan and perform? We're not worthy. But if takaza is there, what you can do? Now, if somebody is drowning there, you say, no, I'm not worthy of saving somebody. No, but at that time, whatever you got at your disposal, if you don't know how to swim, you take a rope and throw it at him. I catch the rope and pull you out. Whatever you got, you'll do that. You can't at that time say that, no, I'm not worthy of this thing. Who am I to save somebody's life? No, I'm not worthy. No, this is a foolish, shaitani way of thinking. It's either our nafs, we don't want to put ourselves forward and do the kaam, or we're showing off, one of the two. We mustn't be like that. We must put ourselves forward. The takaza is up, mutayahu. We must be an arrow. Be an arrow of Allah Ta'ala. Wherever you have to be shot, go. Go, take, do the kaam. Yeah, if there's other people there to do it, then you stay in the shadows. If there's nobody to do it, go and do it. Do the kaam. Now, when we won't do this, there's one masjid, right? In Durban area. Now, Durban got how many ulama? Too many. This masjid get a full house for Jummah. It's not in a like a residential area as such. So you don't get too many people in the weekend, you don't get too many people in the Fajr time, Isha time. But that area too is growing now. People are moving into the area. So that place they battle to get somebody for Jummah. In Durban, St. Durban. You're battling to get people to perform Jummah namaz. So, one person, he's a, I don't know what's his qualification or whatever. So he started availing himself. He's not an alim or anything. And he's from, other side of the river, you know. So he started availing himself. Whenever they need a Jummah speaker, he's available. Yeah. So now the community start taking to him. They start taking to him. But he's full of bid'at, khurafat, wrong. Right? But they're taking to him because he is availing himself to do the work. The masjid was left yatim. Anybody could have went and started having some program there, started doing something for the Muslims there, but nobody wanted to do. We all too busy, or we not worthy, So now, he took that masjid in his Kabu. Now every week he has one program there, one zikr program, ladies coming there, everything. Now we'll say, what's all this? Fitna, this, that. It's too late. Those Muslims don't want to hear your story about your fitna now. When we needed somebody here, you never come. This man came, he saw to our need. So now we listen to him. Now whose fault now? Whose fault? Our own fault. Because we don't want to put ourselves forward to do the work. We must put ourselves forward. There's a takaza of deen, put ourselves forward. There's nobody to do that thing, I must do it. I can't leave it. So I have to go to that masjid sometime because I used to have to go. Now, inshallah, I won't have to go so often. But I went inside there now. I'm seeing all big cameras and small masjid where I think the cameras quarter, the masjid space. What happened? They brought one Palestinian brother there. He was a Palestinian living here in South Africa or something. They put him there now to talk about Gaza, and the whole thing is on the televised. Ladies there, men, sab kuch andar, maskal andar, everything is happening. But you can't tell them anything now. Because this is the man who put himself forward. He put himself forward. Then we complain now, or that Salafi people came away there. Shia people came away there. Who left the void? Who left the void? We left the void. We now filled the gap. So then you gave them space. So now they went. Now after they go and they start their musti, then we want to take out pamphlets, and then we want to say this and we want to say that. It's too late. He already took Kabul of the place. Finish. You can make how much noise you want to make now. Nobody going to listen to you. Understand? Allah Ta'ala had, when Madina Munawara, and I just come out of the haram, right? Just came out of the haram. Now when you're there, you'll make dua. One of the duas you'll make is, Ya Allah, use me for your deen. Allah accept. When I came to the room, I'm seeing there's a message on my phone from a certain organization. They were having a series of bayans on a certain topic.